I'm terribly sorry that I'm not able to be with you tonight. Through no fault of my own, the Democratic National Committee set a credentials committee hearing for this evening, which originally I had thought would be set at another time. The matter before the credentials committee tonight is the recognition of the National Democratic Party of Alabama, or the recognition of the regular Alabama Democratic Party, regarding the selection of the national committeeman from that state. Our interest in it, in the case, as an organization began long ago. You recall at the Democratic National Convention of 1968, there was an Alabama challenge. A new political party had been organized there by black and white liberals, and they attempted to gain seating at the Democratic National Convention, but were rejected. They were rejected largely on the basis of evidence, or so-called evidence, which had been compiled by members of the Alabama Democratic Party, which said that they were not a legal party and that they couldn't place candidates on the ballot in the November general election. The evidence consisted of an affidavit from the head of the county commissioners of Madison County, Alabama, that's Huntsville. He said that no one had asked him if they could hold a mass meeting in the courthouse on election day, which is the way that you would have started the political party under Alabama law. He secondly said that, the second affidavit rather said that the people wouldn't tell a newspaper reporter when their meeting was to be held, which of course they had no obligation to do with that reporter or any other. And the third affidavit was from the person that they relied upon who said that he knew John Cashin and that John Cashin wasn't at that meeting. Of course, that man turned out to be blind. That's right, totally blind, and head of the local courthouse operation where you have the concession stand and you go in and get your coffee. Well, the blind man had given an affidavit, and the Secretary of State of Alabama, named Mabel S. Amos, had decided on the basis of that evidence that this was not a lawful party. On September the 10th, she denied him ballot position. They had 139 black candidates, black and white candidates, running for office in the state. By September the 13th, we were in federal court in the United States District Court in Montgomery, contending they'd been deprived of 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment, and First Amendment rights. George Wallace, you'll recall, had gone into court in Ohio to procure a position on the ballot there. We used Mr. Wallace's case in Ohio as a basis in his own home state to allow a political party of a truly liberal nature to be placed on the ballot there. The federal district court decided, three judges, unanimously, that the evidence upon the so-called evidence was not evidence which could be used to bar a political party from the ballot, but then ruled 2-1 that these candidates had not complied with the corrupt practices laws. Judge Frank M. Johnson, Jr. dissented. We then went to the Supreme Court of the United States prior to the election, and the Supreme Court, they ruled against us on 2-1 on October the 11th. By October the 12th, we were in Washington with the record and had filed our request for temporary relief with Mr. Justice Hugo Black. Mr. Justice Black recused himself because his sister-in-law, Virginia Durr, was one of the NDPA candidates for office, presidential elector. By the following Monday, the Supreme Court ruled, 8 members sitting, that we should be temporarily restored to the ballot and set a special hearing for the following Friday, October the 18th. At that time, we argued the case before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court then ruled on October the 19th that we should be granted ballot position. Then the case came on for argument again as the first case argued during the Nixon administration. And we argued before the Supreme Court there. They allocated 2 hours and 40 minutes and decided March 25th that not only should the party have been placed on the ballot, but that it was wrongfully left off the ballot by the probate judge of Greene County, Alabama. And from that case came the recent Greene County election, which many of you are familiar with, in which 6 blacks were elected and took over both governing bodies of the major governing bodies of the first county in the Deep South. 4 were elected to the county commission and 2 were elected to the school board. Now, our position in this case is that the Alabama Democratic Party, a 72-man, all-white state executive committee, which has selected a white committee man, the state not having cast a ballot for a Democratic president, a full electoral vote for the Democratic nominee for president, but one time since 1944, is not entitled to represent the black and white liberal citizens of the state of Alabama, who comprised the vote that went for the National Democratic Party nominee in the last election. That vote was 95% black, according to John F. Kraft Incorporated, political pollsters here in Washington, who provided us with information. Consequently, we present what might be termed a one-man, one-vote case, saying that the voters of a political party are entitled to representation on that party's national committee. Democratic Party years ago was held subject to the courts and subject to rules of law in the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment in voter rights cases in the South. We intend to follow this case through tonight, present our case, give the National Committee an opportunity to act. When it does not do so, or if it does not do so, then in turn it looks like we'll have to go back to court in what appears to be a never-ending battle relating to voter law. Lynn asked me to talk with you a bit about the general state of civil liberties in the South, and all we can say about that is that the South is still the creature of George Wallace and the apparent Phillips, Mitchell-Nixon thesis, as we call it, which is written in the emerging Republican majority, calls for a constant slowing of civil rights enforcement in the South. Although they contend that that is not their position, it seems to be very well laid out by Mr. Phillips, who is special assistant to Mr. Mitchell, the Attorney General. And in so doing, in the recent appointments to the Supreme Court of Judge Haynesworth and the sundry activities and actions of the weakening and of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare and school integration, in the continued action of the Department of Justice and its altered position with respect to the Mississippi cases and other cases seeking a slowdown, they have managed to give the white segregationist South new hope. And all a white segregationist Southerner needs is a little bit of hope, and he'll fight a civil war. Consequently, we've probably been set back much, much further than we ordinarily would think, that rational people would think that we'd been set back. George Wallace is lurking in the wings. The Republican Party seems to think somehow that it can move in on George Wallace and that Wallace will not be a candidate for re-election or that he will not run for president of the United States. In response to that is that George Wallace is the Sammy Glick of American politics. If you ask George Wallace why he was going to run, he would simply answer, because it is there. Wallace is a candidate and a very real force through the deep South states of Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, where you have that histrionic trio of Lester Maddox, George Corley Wallace, John Bell Williams. You still have the center of reaction in the United States and a great deprivation of civil liberties. Now, the real problem for the civil rights movement, of course, and the civil liberties movement in the South, is that we're not able, at this particular point in history, to gain the cohesive force and strength that we need to move forward in this nation. There are many reasons for that. One of them is that which most white Southerners, segregationists, surely always felt would come to pass. And that was that as soon as the Civil Rights Revolution hit the North, that Northerners would weaken, and once they weakened, the South would win its cause as it did before, as it had before, the white South, as it did after Reconstruction. Many do not know that segregation didn't begin, really, by statute, Jim Crow laws. The first was passed by Florida in 1887. It was not until the presidency of Woodrow Wilson finally capped segregation, that great American president, Woodrow Wilson, that we all learned to revere in history books as a wonderful liberal man, was quite a segregationist also. He managed to fire all the Democratic Negro office holders that remained in Washington when he came, and before his administration was over, he had completely authorized and legitimatized racial segregation in the nation's capital. He even, as a matter of fact, went to see the Birth of a Nation, approved of it, and in so doing helped shape the attitudes of the American people for the coming decade. An entire generation's attitudes were shaped by both him and by the then Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, who also saw the Birth of a Nation, and who also recommended it. And it was used by Dixon and others who were promoting the Birth of the Nation as lending authenticity to it, which then gave rise, of course, to the Klan as a political instrument, of course, not merely in the South, but throughout the country. Well, what we see now happening in Washington is, by the deactivation of the Supreme Court, and this is really a rather harrowing thing to me, as I explained to many people last fall. When I was 8 years old, Mr. Justice Black and Mr. Justice Douglas were on the Supreme Court of the United States. At that time, I was 38 years of age, and I inquired as to whether or not that meant I would be practicing law before a Supreme Court that Mr. Nixon appointed until I was 68. It becomes increasingly apparent that is the case. Some of the other cases we have going, of course, Muhammad Ali's wiretap case, in which we went in to garner what evidence we could, walked into court fully expecting that they picked up a conversation between him and Malcolm X, and then walked out of court discovering it was Martin Luther King Jr., amongst others. found that the FBI had had a wiretap and a bug on the residence of Elijah Muhammad, the leader of his religion, for a total of 4 years, and that the FBI employed clerks who had nothing better to do than sit around and listen to other people's conversations on 8-hour shifts, one of whom sat there for 4 years. I can't imagine even Marilyn Monroe having been so interesting as to listen to 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, for 4 years, but that's the way some of these young men have to spend their careers. In turn, we did bring the wiretap evidence into the open, and of course, in that conscientious objector case, the FBI is charged with the duty of compiling a report, and that report is used as the basis for the Justice Department recommendation as to whether or not he should be granted conscientious objector relief. A part of the Justice Department's recommendation that he not be granted conscientious objector status was based upon the fact that his beliefs were, in fact, the beliefs based on racial and political aspects of his religion. We contend that since they listened to the religion's leader for 4 years, we're entitled to see the entire file of that religious leader, Elijah Muhammad. Well, we're entitled to it, not the rest of the world, just the lawyers and the member of that religion, who has been denied conscientious objector status based upon that that approach of the FBI's and of the Department of Justice's time. In other cases, Dr. Levy's case, of course, some of you will note or remember that we recently Dr. Levy was ordered released by Mr. Justice Douglas. We had sought bail pending habeas corpus in the first civilian review of the merits of his case. We have a habeas corpus petition pending in Pennsylvania now in the Middle District of Pennsylvania. We sought relief pending habeas corpus and sought Dr. Levy's release on bail. It was denied by the district court, denied by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, denied by Mr. Justice Brennan, sitting as circuit justice for that circuit, and then granted by Mr. Justice Douglas, who in effect overruled everybody. That has caused a little disturbance in Congress, where Congressman F. Edward Hebert from the state of Louisiana, not noted for either his liberalism or his intellectual capacities, has sent off another one of his perennial messages to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He constantly wrote Chief Justice Warren on several occasions, but he has now written Chief Justice Berger, asking Chief Justice Berger to overrule Mr. Justice Douglas, who overruled Mr. Justice Brennan, and that matter will come up for be submitted to the entire court on October the 6th. In the event we lose, then Dr. Levy will go back to jail for a few days, and then he'll be released with good time served. If we win, then we've established a precedent regarding the release on bail pending habeas and the reasons for granting bail in First Amendment cases. Other cases that we're handling, of course, are familiar to some of you, and they generally revolve around race, and that race is and remains the principal question in the South, in Southern politics, voter law, in Southern jury law. With respect to the court system, we now have prison integration suits pending, and we've already won integration cases at the prisons, and people ask about that, and we can just respond to them, well, look, it may be the greatest deterrent to white crime in the history of the South in the first place. In the second place, the prisons probably are the South's biggest educational institution. In Alabama, in one order, probably the broadest in desegregation order issued yet, we managed to integrate or receive an order to do so, at least, over approximately 1,000 prison and penal facilities, every city, county, and town jail in the state, as well as the state penitentiaries. In the state of Georgia, we've been successful in a case brought to integrate the prison system in the state of Georgia. We now have pending cases in South Carolina, Louisiana, and in Mississippi. What we're attempting to do still is to integrate the system of justice. Whites in the North and around the country do not seem to understand that two-thirds of the blacks who live out of the South were born and reared below the Mason-Dixon line. Their view of the system of justice is the white man's country, the sheriff, the big beefy fella down in Lowndes County. They went to the courthouse only when they had to go to the courthouse. They went there to see their sons and wives and mothers and fathers sent off to jail. What we're attempting to do is to bring blacks into the system of justice so that they can have respect for law. And so when liberals come to them and say, take your struggle out of the streets and into the courts, at that particular point, they don't have to turn around and think instinctively and correctly, out of the streets and into the enemy? How ridiculous we must be to think that people would do such a thing. Now, regarding Minnesota and the problems of race. I know that the nation itself is caught up in the throes. A great number of people have been thinking that there's a Black Panther in every garage and that a whole generation has gone to pot. I know that that is not true and that the ACLU must move constantly on behalf of the poor and the oppressed, the minority people of this land. Must move in the South to change the South, and at the same time must move all across the nation in order to preserve and protect at least those institutions which we value and pride ourselves on having. It may very well be that the Supreme Court is about to become a deactivated instrument in the struggle for social justice. If so, then we may have to move more and more and increasingly into the field of educating the electorate of America in order to achieve social justice. I do know, though, that as far as we're concerned in the ACLU and in the South, that we're going to seek to free the black from the bondage of slavery and the white man and the South from the bondage of the black. And we're going to seek to then free the nation from the bondage of the South. And perhaps when that happens, the United States can have abroad the sort of policy and demonstrate abroad the sort of policy that its promise is at home. All we have to do is to practice democracy here, protect the rights of all men, and guarantee freedom to each and every American, regardless of their race, or their color, or their economic status. And if we can do that, then we have at home the sort of foreign policy that will not make it necessary for us to fight in wars in Vietnam and other places, almost always on the wrong side.